man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
All right, how's it going, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Whiteway, and in the virtual studio with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the king of the critics, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Oh, Ify, you're sweet, but no. Okay, so what's exciting for me is maybe somebody who is the king of the critics. I'm a big fan of Mark Harris. He writes for Vulture. He is somebody who has, you know, tried my hand at writing books about movies. I think he's one of the foremost practitioners of it right now. He did Pictures of a Revolution, which was about the Best Picture nominees of 1967. He did Five Came Back, which got turned into that amazing Netflix documentary. And his new book about Mike Nichols just comes out this week. And I'm just starting it, but like, he's just so fascinating. I'm not even the biggest Mike Nichols fan in the world, but I think by the end of this book, I'm going to be so completely into what he's about. And Nichols's life is so amazing. This is a guy who started out basically kind of, he and Elaine May were one of the sort of earliest practitioners of improv comedy. He then becomes like this legendary Broadway director and then movie director and child of immigrants, the whole nine yards. So it's an incredible story, and you know, it's a filmography that includes things like, you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate and Heartburn and you know, all these other amazing films. So I'm you know, just so thrilled whenever there's a new Mark Harris book, but I think this one specifically is going to be really great. So yeah, check it out. Mark Harris's new Mike Nichols book.
Nice. Ooh. I once stayed at an Airbnb like deep in the woods that barely had electricity and fully had a record player. Oh. And they had two Nichols and May like comedy albums. And so I sat in a cabin in the woods with barely electricity and a record player and listened to two Nichols and May. So I wonder if Mark Harris is going to talk about me doing that or those albums.
Yeah, he stayed in that cabin too, as it turned out.
Sure, sure.
And that other voice you hear that you know and love, well, it's none other than the Queen of the Midwest. That's Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
What's good with me is, so my nephew is a senior in high school in sort of upstate New York. They think they're closer to the city than they are, but they're in New York. And you know, he hasn't been in school with his friends since March of his junior year. And that's such a bummer to even imagine that. And he's an incredible swimmer. And, you know, the swim season got pushed, but it is one of the sports that is more cleared because it's, you know, an individual, no contact sport. And anyway, he's starting up his swim season, and the coach, because the obviously they're close to spectators, the coach asked the families to put together like basically the top half of mannequin bodies. Like they stuffed sweatshirts with pillows and put cardboard cutouts of like everyone in the family's heads. And they're like holding signs to sort of recreate the idea of a crowd. And I found that so touching, and it made me weep like many things do at this point. But basically what's good for me is any kind of educator or coach that's like going this extra step to try and retain some sort of specialness. Like normalcy is well past us, but to be making things feel just a little more special, I thought that was great. So hip hip to Jack's swim coach. And yeah, I hope Jack wins everything. But yeah, that was what's good for me. A what's good that, you know, brought me to tears. But, you know, yeah. what doesn't?
But that sounds very good. It also makes me wonder, how hard is Lars and the Real Girl hitting right now? Is that is that the quarantine move? The quarantine move?
Yes. Like, oh, I wonder what my sister would think if I sent like a sex doll, but like in a tasteful athleisure outfit. Like,
yeah.
You know? Holding a sign that says, go Jack.
Just bring this to the pool full of teenage boys. What's the problem? Yeah,
don't worry. What can go wrong?
Yeah.
Oh, well, and we also have an esteemed, illustrious, wonderful, top to bottom, all around, good town, Rolo Tony, take me to town. Yes, that is the co-host of Screen Drafts Podcast. You've heard us all on this podcast at this point. It's Clay Keller. What's good?
Well, thank you. It's not often I get an introduction where at least three of the words I don't know what they mean, but I'm going to assume.
Rolo Tony?
I'm going to assume that's complimentary. So thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah, all three of you guys have been on Screen Draft, so I'm delighted to be able to join you in this forum. What is good? What is good? What is good? What is good? I was going to recommend something based on what the kind of template that Alonzo set. And I'm halfway through my rewatch of Search Party, getting up towards season 4, which just came out, which I'm enjoying very much. Then Drea shared sort of a personal anecdote. So I was saying, well, should it be something more of a personal anecdote? And I thought just today on Twitter, something nice happened. In the future, in a couple of months, our friend Billy Ray Bruton and his Scripts Gone Wild read series is doing My Favorite Movie Broadcast News. Drea, you've been a part of that. Alonzo, have you ever done Scripts Gone Wild?
I guess my invitation got lost.
Not yet. I'm sure Billy Ray would love to have you. But Drea and Iffy have both been on. And we're doing Broadcast News, my all-time favorite movie. It's the thing I'm always talking about and tweeting about. I can't shut up about it. I'm going to do it, and Clark Wolf's going to do it. Dave Schilling's going to do it. It's going to be a really fun time. But I tweeted at Mark Shaman. I said, Mark, you gotta hop on this in April, this charity live read, and play the news theme. Because one of the most memorable parts of that movie is Mark Shaman didn't compose the film. It was Bill Condon, but Mark Shaman appears as a character in the film as a composer coming to play the new news theme for the director of the news department. It's very memorable. They play the news theme and a big finish. Anybody who loves that movie knows that bit. So I tweeted at Mark Shaman, and he tweeted back and said, like, you know, I'm on the East Coast, so this seems like it would go pretty late. If I stayed up that late, I might die. And like, how about that for a big finish? So we're negotiating to try and maybe he can pop on earlier and say hi or something, but it was very fun to interact with the legendary Mark Shaman and have him quote his part in the movie, I don't know, like, it's a movie from 30 years ago and he's in it for 5 seconds. I didn't know how much the movie means to him or it doesn't. Actually, I was in a space with him once and I almost worked up the courage to approach him. And not to tell him what any of his work means to me, but to specifically tell him that I love his 10-second part in Broadcast News.
That's his acting work. I think he'd appreciate that.
I think he'd appreciate it. He seems like a very, very fun guy. And I chickened out, but hopefully I will have that opportunity again.
You're Twitter friends.
Yeah. Now that we're Twitter buddies.
By the way, don't send us emails. The composer on Broadcast News was Bill Conti.
Bill Condon's a director. Yes. Bill Conti. Thank you, Alonzo.
Sure. Iffy, what's good?
quick it is.
And Iffy's wearing a shirt that says good on it, by the way.
That's so true.
That almost seems like cute.
What's good?
It was shirt? Right there. No. Yeah.
What's good with me is, I'm moving to a new place and the Herculean venture of moving 80 plus pairs of shoes that you have in boxes has been what's good with me. It's taken over my life. It's what I was doing before this. And I'm almost done, but I'm debating. I truly am like, do I need this many shoes? Why do I have this many shoes? But when I'm done, I'll go back to enjoying these shoes that I wear. And sometimes people notice how cool they are.
Iffy, I have a shoe question, and please tell me if I'm derailing your podcast. My podcast goes on forever and ever, so I know you guys are a little bit more.
I'm open to shoe questions.
As a person who owns 3.5 pairs of shoes, people who have a lot of shoes, it always fascinates me. Do you have a special way that you organize or display them? Does your new place have like a shoe room, or how do you?
I pretty much what I did is I layer them on the bottom of the closet and then the top shelf of the closet, and then everything that doesn't fit goes under the bed. We are reaching critical mass. I just remembered, I was like, oh, I have most of the shoes that are in the closet. I don't have the ones that are under the bed. And I, even like when I dropped off this last batch of shoes, I was like, okay, I'm almost done. And I saw like four stacks of shoes on my bed, and I was like, oh, I made a mistake. But yeah, so I pretty much try and fit them, but there's a lot of places that sell these like shoe box towers. And I'm like, no, because I'm a weirdo who likes to keep the boxes themselves. So I'm making it hard on myself.
Yeah, I mean, they retain their value more if you keep them in the box.
Yeah, because you could, that is very true. Because you can sell them in box. I mean, the moment you...
Oh, I was making a joke. That's true.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, that's exactly true. They retain their value, because if you sell a pair of shoes, but you can't sell them without the box, you have to cut that price almost in half.
I don't think I've owned 80 pairs of shoes in my life, let alone concurrently.
Well, okay. Final factoid is one of the hot shoes that you're looking for is the LeBron Miamis. And that's, I bring that up to say we are discussing One Night in Miami, and we're going to do a deep dive into the Sundance Film Festival. And after that, you know, we have our staff picks, but first it's time for our news segment. Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the question, is this important? Do I care? First up, we lost a great one. Cicely Tyson, trailblazing actor Cicely Tyson, passed away this week. For those unfamiliar with her career, let me fill you in. She was nominated for an Oscar for the film Sounder in 1972. She won two Emmys for the TV movie The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, portraying a woman born into slavery who lives to the 20th century civil rights movements. Some other notable roles include her work in Roots, The Help, and the Tony Award-winning performance for the 2013 The Trip to Bountiful. She was awarded an honorary Oscar in 2018, the only Black woman to ever receive this honor, and she received the Presidential Medal of Honor from President Barack Obama in 2016. And by the end of her career, she was nominated for a total of 15 Emmys, and she was 96. Fun fact, 2016 is a year after the first woman was ever awarded a Medal of Honor, which was a nurse in the Civil War. That's a fun fact. I played a trivia board game recently, and that just tied in. Is this important? Do you care?
That very really much. Fueled your thing. Yes, I loved Cicely Tyson. So elegant, so beautiful. I love these performances. Sounder, I watched forever ago. Sounder, incidentally, is the name of the dog in the movie. And for some reason, like it was always in my head as a dog movie before I saw it, because someone had said that to me. It is not. It's about sharecroppers. And she is... ugh, she's incredible. I think that her choices of her career, a career that certainly was also influenced by the fact that she was a Black woman and limited by that. And yet the roles that she sought out, I think, were empowering and distinctive in really, really special ways. And I'm also forever fascinated by the fact that she had like a decades long on and off relationship with Miles Davis, and they were married for a while, and it was a whole thing, and she like saw him through his addiction and got him clean, and then he got, anyway, she's a, so much going on in her life, and she died while promoting her autobiography, like 96, still working.
Yeah,
still
I was gonna say hard. She passed 2 days after the publication of her memoir, which is like, you know, that's as the character says in Breathless, who says his ambition is to become immortal and then die. that's pretty astonishing. And our good friend Travell Anderson, who co-hosts the Fanti podcast here on Max Fun, had a great suggestion on Twitter, which is that we need to A, buy her book, and B, buy it online from a Black-owned bookstore, which is a move I highly recommend and think that we should do. But yeah, Tyson has a great career, and it is... you know, I think a mark on Hollywood that she didn't have more of a big screen career. I mean, it's great that she had so many opportunities on television, and she certainly made the most of those. But yeah, she should have had a much, much bigger career. But in the 70s, certainly during the apex of her career, Hollywood just did not have interesting things or ideas or roles for Black women. And you know, I'm glad that she was able to find success on Broadway and in other media, but you know, it is shame on the film industry for not making better use of Cicely Tyson when they could have.
Yeah, hands down. And it totally reminded me of other like Hollywood shames regarding race, not the other ones. But my original what's good that I totally forgot when I was put on the spot was I was going to look up the first black movie star, which was Lincoln Perry, who his claim to fame was playing Stephen Fitchit, which was the lazy
Stephen Fitchit.
Okay, well,
like
if
it's
y'all
a terrible
saw,
pun.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it just if while we're on the subject of, you know, bad.
I like how he tried to make it French. Stephane Fitchit.
Mr. She, but
the T is silent.
But like, yeah, this is it's just
there was another actor of that era whose stage name was literally Sleep and Eat. So, you know,
yeah,
this is what we're dealing with here.
Yeah. So, you know, it's and in a if I can see the silver lining, you kind of see the growth when you look as far back as that. And then you look at Cicely Tyson's career, who like most of her movies were like Slave and The Help movies. And now we're in this like renaissance of black film right now. I think that's an important thing to like think on and highlight during Black History Month. So that's my take on that.
The Golden Globe nominations dropped this week. So in terms of the nominations, what's important and what do you care about?
Every year. Every year this happens. We everybody gets upset about the Golden Globes, spends 364 days talking about how the Golden Globes are moronic and we shouldn't give them an ounce of thought. And then the next nominations happen and everybody's upset again.
Oh, but then the day comes where they give them out and everybody gets very concerned about who won and who didn't win.
Yeah.
And what
does
this mean for the Oscars? And then we go back to thinking, oh yeah, the Golden Globes are stupid.
It's a reminder of, or I'd like to remind people of, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is who nominates and awards these. It is comprised of like 70 international film critics.
They're not critics.
They
are entertainment writers.
I put that in quotes, but people listening cannot hear. And that is it's an important distinction because how they view things. I'll say as someone who literally had to put together a prediction list of this so I could figure out my studios and networks ahead of time, like music, there's a nominee that wasn't even on my prediction list, which is the directed by Sia movie called Music. About an autistic girl. Like, they're always the curveballs that the Globes will give you is just this. Yes, why not do it? I love the chaos theory.
They dug
nominees.
Into the movie that everybody on the internet is already furious about because Sia not only cast a neurotypical actress in the role of an autistic person, but then was like really nasty about it when people
super
called her on
like,
it on Twitter
to parental groups. She's like, oh, I don't care. Yeah, no. Such a good call.
So, way to go, Globes.
Yeah. Anyway, should be exciting. There are, I will say, we have three female directors, rightfully so.
Amen.
All films I'm very excited about and that were on my top 10 list.
But they nominated all the white Netflix movies and none of the black Netflix movies, right? Like no Five Bloods and no...
Yes, in the best drama and best comedy musical categories. The acting categories have a little more... Parsity? Words?
Parody.
My God, thank you. I was trying to
just repeated what they said.
I was trying to make you didn't know. I was combining things. Anyway, the Golden Globes, I can't wait to hear everybody mock the winners in just a 6 more weeks.
Well, you know, it's going to be weird having them A, not be in the same room, and B, not being drunk. Well, I guess maybe they could be drunk at home.
They're still going to be drunk, my friends.
Yeah.
They might be more drunk.
This is true. They don't have to drive anywhere.
Our say, they'll be more drunk.
My favorite line about the Golden Globes that I saw today online was, if the only person you're nominating from Hamilton is Lin-Manuel Miranda, you're doing it wrong.
100%. 100%.
Oh,
that's where Leslie Odom, and he is actually, Leslie Odom Jr. is the only person from today's movie who was nominated.
No, Regina King got nominated.
Well, actors.
Actors.
Oh, actor-wise, yeah. Yes. Well, because you had to get Jared Leto in there, Dre. You got to make room for Jared Leto.
And his tummy pouch.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, we're going to get more into Leslie Odom Jr. when we talk about One Night in Miami when we come back from this break.
All right, once again, we are delighted to have the support of Storyblocks backing up Who Shot Ya. Storyblocks is dedicated to being the world's best royalty-free stock media subscription service with an ever-growing library of stock assets, including music, images, sound effects, and more. And it is a lot more. I've been on the website.
So if you're in a position where you have to make a slick, professional-looking video for your business or your event, and you're thinking, no, I'm terrified of the technology, because I certainly am all the time. I'm an old man. I am no Steven Spielberg. I can't do this. Well, no. You don't have to be Steven Spielberg. They make it so easy for you.
They have affordable subscription plans and tools. And with Storyblocks Unlimited All Access Plan, you can get unlimited downloads of everything in their library. And guess what? Even if your subscription ends, everything you've downloaded is yours to keep. That is an amazing deal, trust me. In 2020, Storyblocks launched Restock, an initiative to increase diversity in their library. Storyblocks is committing to having 20% of their footage contain Black, Indigenous, and people of color by 2022, with plans to expand their scope to include more underrepresented groups in the future. That is dope.
Yeah, if you've ever needed stock imagery or wanted to build out something, you'll know that that is sadly lacking in many areas on other platforms. So please explore their library and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/whoshot. That's storyblocks.com/whoshot.
Hey there, beautiful people. Did you hear that good, good news?
Something about the baby Jesus?
He's coming back.
Or do you mean the fact that Apple Podcasts has named Fanti one of the best shows of 2020?
I mean, we already knew that we was hot stuff, but a little external validation never hurts, okay?
Hosted by me, writer and journalist Jared Hill.
And me, the ebony enchantress myself, Javel Anderson.
Fanti is your home for complex conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the people, places, and things we're huge fans of, but got some anti-feelings toward.
You name it, we fan-tie you. Nobody's off limits.
Check us out every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your Slayworthy audio.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya. I'm your host, Vivi Whiteyway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Clay Keller.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking about One Night in Miami. Drea, would you mind providing us with a brief synopsis?
All right. One Night in Miami, you guys, takes place all in one night in Miami. So that's a lie. There's some intro sections, but it primarily follows the activities and events of an evening after a young Cassius Clay defeats Sonny Liston in a boxing match. And then he meets up with three of his friends. All four of these are enormous celebrities in different fields. So it's a fascinating blend. You have Cassius Clay, more well known to most of us now as Muhammad Ali. You have the iconic Nation of Islam leader Malcolm X, influential singer-songwriter, record producer Sam Cooke, and star NFL running back Jim Brown. And so the four of these men come together, height of their fame. Well, no, not even, but they're famous, they're talented, they're powerful, and they're talking about really important things, both intimate and personal and cultural and sort of civil rights. And so, yeah, they take on a lot in this One Night in Miami. Yeah, I worked in the title twice.
We thought you couldn't do it, Drea.
Yes, they said it couldn't be done.
I was in the chat with Iffy and Alonzo saying, there's no way Drea fits the title in twice.
Is she? Will it? She? Can she?
Oh, man. So this is a good question that I want to kick off because, I have thoughts on it. But what were your expectations of this film prior to see it? And were they met?
I mean, for me, this is like, you know, reading that it was it's written by Kemp Powers, who also wrote Soul, incidentally, based on his play. And I thought, okay, this is going to be a play about four historical figures meeting in a Miami hotel room. And I was immediately expecting a much more sort of pared down production, especially because this is Regina King's feature directorial debut. She's directed a lot of episodic TV, but this is her first big screen movie. And I was taken aback almost immediately. This movie lets you know it is not just going to be four guys stuck in a hotel room talking. You know, we get flashbacks and flash forwards. We get kind of a, you know, I haven't seen the play, but I'm imagining what would be sort of a prologue and epilogue that didn't exist on stage. Not unlike what the Netflix version of Boys in the Band does, but whereas the next version of Boys in the Band, I think, kind of undoes the power of that claustrophobia in telling that story. This time, I think it provides really important context for who these characters are, how they exist in the world, how they are perceived in the world, and also really allows Regina King to, like, look, I'm going to stage a full musical sequence. Oh, and look, now a boxing match. And now, like, there's a lot of stuff happening here, and she's handling it all with a great deal of finesse. So I was really surprised that the movie didn't feel locked into its theatrical origins.
Ooh, I want to jump right into that because I was feeling the same way. I feel like we have seen on this pod so many movies that were plays, and 99% of the time I've not known they were plays, and then halfway through I'm like, they ain't leaving. But this time I did know it was a play going in, so I was like, okay, I'm ready. And then I was surprised because then it does break out. The one time I knew it was a play, it breaks out. And I think you're right. It doesn't do it unnecessarily. So it really, it's like, almost like a beautiful dance is playing. It like lets this tension build up and then it separates and let everyone breathe and then brings them right back together. And you could really kind of feel the flow of it. And that's what I think makes it work on a stage play, is that ebb and flow you have when you're watching the stage play, where you're getting to the crescendo of the scene and then a character has to walk off stage and then you're left with these other characters. So I also agree. It really is probably one of my current, you know, within the recent few years, a handling of a stage play to a movie.
For sure. I think too, and I actually think that Mark Harris mentioned this or made this point, so that Alonso, of course, brought up Mark Harris earlier. And it's fitting because Mark Harris is married to a playwright. So, but I think he tweeted something once about how the expectation of audience viewers when they're watching theatrical adaptations to film and making easy critiques as in, oh, it just felt like a play, and why that was considered pejorative. And where plays give a lot more weight to the words, and you'll have longer conversations that maybe then would feel natural for most people. Not for Clay Keller, because all of his conversations are long, but like for the rest of the world, like not everybody talks so long about a single thing. But my expectations of this were met and then exceeded, because I did wonder how she would handle this. What I was like, oh, this is for, it's a stage play, it's going to be four men, it's going to be, I'm ready, I'm down for it. And then it really opens that world. She also really took advantage. It's this small, and it's alluded to being a crappy hotel room, and we're still getting different sides of it, different pieces we're moving, that like you're, as Iffy mentioned, the sort of flow from room to room, or they take a respite on the roof, and there's just things breaking it up that even beyond the like larger set pieces of like, oh, I saw your show, and then they go to the show or whatever. Yeah. Even just within the hotel, it still felt cinematic while giving me all of the like juicy wordplay and deep conversations that I would expect from a theater performance.
Yeah, and that's what impressed me most with this movie. I was not aware that it was a play going in. I figured it out fairly quickly. I'm a pretty smart cookie, but I am.
All right, relax.
I appreciate it. I oftentimes, I think as you guys were all alluding to, when you adapt a play and the epilogues, the prologues, the bits where they add in, you know, if someone references something, then they bring us there in the movie, like you couldn't on a stage play. Sometimes that stuff feels unmotivated or unnecessary. And all of this stuff, all of the parts that they leave the hotel room really fit in nicely with the rest of it. And Regina King certainly got to kind of flex her muscles with those. But the really, as you were saying, Drea, the most impressive part of this movie to me was how she directed the scenes in the hotel room. It is very difficult to choreograph, to move the camera, to stage and cut around characters in a confined space like that and make it visually interesting and not claustrophobic, unless it's, you know, supposed to be. And she does a great job of that. I mean, it is a simple thing of moving the characters, moving the cameras, the compositions. And it's often invisible work that you only notice when it starts to feel dusty or stagey. And that's when people get on Twitter and say, oh, this just felt like a play. If when you don't do that, they just feel like these great scenes. And the play's written really well, as Ivy was saying, with having, you know, characters kind of butt heads and the tension comes up and then they split off and you get new character combinations and it resets the tone of the scene and you get a new perspectives on things. So yeah, the structure of the play mixed with her really deft handling of the direction of those bits. And of course, we'll talk about the performances at length, I assume. Yeah. But all of that, I was very impressed with what Regina King did with that.
Yeah, it reminds me of a joke that Edward Albee would talk about regarding this. Another writer got credited as the screenwriter for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and I think even an Oscar nomination for his adaptation. And Albee's joke was, yeah, that guy wrote two lines, let's go to the roadhouse and let's go back from the roadhouse. But yeah, in this movie, it's a lot smoother. Like, I would be fascinated to go back and either see or at least read the play and just kind of find out what the original structure was like. And well, you know.
Yeah.
One of the standout things that, and you can tell me, because I'm going to make you go back and read the play. You can do some homework for the rest of us. But, you know, you mentioned that why I said it's not all in one night is because we have these very quick vignettes with each of the characters where we discover who they are, what their place in the world is, their backstory. You get all of this exposition and they are so beautifully done because they are heavy in exposition, but also no heavy lifting is happening. It's completely, you're getting story of like I thought that Aldous Hodge, who plays Jim Brown, and he has this scene with Beau Bridges.
Oh my God.
Took my breath away. And he gets there and they're deep Georgia and it's 1964 and he invites him in and he's just like, Beau Bridges is just blowing smoke.
He doesn't
up his
invite
ass.
Him in, Drea.
Oh, my friend. Yeah,
that was the
I mean,
biggest,
he invites him into
the biggest parts of that interaction.
He invites him into the sun deck. And like, it's this whole thing. His daughter serves him lemonade. It just seems like the most like, oh, how wonderful. And it is shut down in a way at the end of this scene that I was like, I just got more of this man's life in this 2 second exchange than entire movies that I've seen. And I think each of the characters, what you got of their intimate lives, they all did that just in the same sort of level of polish.
That was probably one of the strongest like openings to me, because like you really like it really set the stage. Like I knew everything I needed to know before we got to the motel room. It showed where everyone was in their life, and it showed their relationship to their blackness, and it showed how they deal with it. And like, because it was interesting because they all kind of technically dealt with the same thing just in different ways, where it was just all like, and you know, you had someone like Cassius who, if you were to compare the four, probably had the best out of everyone, which his thing is he's kind of like the heel, to use wrestling terms, which is quote unquote the bad guy in this like sport to all these white people. But in the end, he is respected because they know he does what he does. And then you have and they're very like upfront about it. Then you have, you know, the Jim Brown situation where he's sitting with someone who is singing his praises up and down around town, and just entering the house is immediately shut down. And the beauty of that scene and the performance of it was the way it was so matter of fact, where it's like, oh, I'm not being offensive. It was like the perfect like display of that type of racism, where it's like, oh, I'm not being racist. This just is how it is. And you know,
see, the politest use of the N-word ever.
Oh, yes.
All the more like, for it. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. The opening 5 minutes of this movie are the most tense I have been watching a movie in years. Just like, oh no, Bo Bridges is going to say something racist. And you just wait and wait and wait. And then when it hits, it's so much worse. It's so much worse than you could imagine.
Well, mine was worse because I was not tense. I was like, how nice. I'm glad that he has this man as a champion on his side.
Yeah. Like, no, I knew it was coming. Oh man.
Yeah. You're smarter than me.
They were setting us up.
I, like I said, the dive that I went into to looking at footage of things, these men were so exquisitely cast and so much embodied. Like, I've never seen, is it Eli Gorey, I believe his name, who played Cassius Clay? I'd not seen him before. He had the physicality. He looked like him. But also, like, that Sonny Liston, his whole, like, I'm the greatest. Like, that exuberance and the energy and the confidence that he was manifesting, like, that's what he was famed for. And, like, people know that. You know that moment. And, like, even if you just know those photos when he was on the ring and, like, lunging out and he's shouting at the crowd, that Regina King captured that. But I thought he was incredible. Leslie Odom Jr. I adore, and I thought gave such depth to Sam Cooke. He was maybe my favorite. It's hard to pick a favorite.
Yeah, phenomenal. I mean, people have talked about how, like, you know, Kingsley Benadire, who's great as Malcolm X, has the challenge of, you know, stepping into Denzel's footsteps. But I mean, like, Eli Gorey has the actual Muhammad Ali to live up to. Like, that's somebody that we all know and we've seen so much footage of and seen as such a larger-than-life character as a person. Like, you know, as somebody who's a huge fan of the documentary The Times of Harvey Milk, I never really bought Sean Penn as Harvey Milk because I knew the real Harvey Milk just from the footage so well. But here, like, even as much as I grew up with Muhammad Ali being kind of a constant presence on TV and being such a figure that even you didn't have to follow sports to know what his deal was and to kind of, you know, hear what he was like, you know, he totally encompasses all of that stuff just brilliantly. But yeah, I think the four of them are great. And, you know, usually when an actor directs for the first time, the one thing you can count on is they're going to get great work out of the cast. So the fact that Regina King did that is just like the minimum bar. And then all the other things that she's pulling off here is really impressive.
There are also unexpected performances. Like, there's several times I'm thinking, like, you get four grown adults, four adult men in a room, and they're having these heated things. I feel like a lot of actors love just, oop, 0 to 100. Let's do this all. Like, we want everything at highest intensity. And to me, there's this scene where Jim Brown and Sam Cooke are sitting, and how Aldous Hodge and Leslie Odom Jr. play it. It's so, they're having the most heated conversation in the calmest tones. It's right in this register. They're sitting, like, you could take that entire scene and I could see people just yelling it and, like, chewing.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Instead, they're, like, in that. They're men who are trying to have this conversation.
When they're all goofing on Malcolm X and, like, playing keep away with his camera, it's like, you never think of Malcolm X as having a sense of humor, you know, like his stuff was by necessity, like, so serious and so important. And his public, you know, face was always very stern. And so to see him as a guy who is with his friends and they are goofing on each other the way friends do, it's like, oh yeah, clearly this guy was a human being. He's not just like the face on, like, Black Mount Rushmore. More, you know?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to talk about, that where you got to see this, like, range of Malcolm X and almost this explanation of being like, it almost feels like the film itself is like, just understand the Malcolm X that we usually see is the one that is presented to us. And there are so many different people in this film that during the film is saying, hey, stop doing the TV stuff. And it's so funny because it's almost kind of winking at the idea of the portrayal of Malcolm X, where every version of him when he's on film is the version he presented to TV. But if he's back home with his wife, if he's with his friends, there's no reason for him to be that version. And to see him get so worked up about, like, the struggle and the fight and like so much that he's, like, moved to tears, like, that was, like, so good.
Vote.
Yes. So we're going to, it's time for us to vote. As you, our listeners, know, but maybe Clay doesn't know, the way we review films on Who Shot Ya in these times, or would you snap it up on physical media, stream it, or skip it? So we're going to let you take the lead as our guest. What is your rating for this movie?
Physical media, stream it, or skip it. Well, look, I mean, when this gets put out on physical media, will it? With these streamers, it's always so hard to tell.
This is more of a metaphorical ranking.
Yes. More a metaphor. Yeah. I would say pick it up on physical media. I went back and rewatched some of it this morning to prep for this. And, you know, especially the second time around, the performances really start to feel like their own real people thing. You're not looking at though, are they doing an impression or not? And it really, you can live in those scenes. And there's a lot to chew on there. Like I would love to talk about this movie with you guys for another 45 minutes. Cause it is a rich text. And as someone who loves performances and acting, it's a, oh man, this one you can go back to. So I would say, what was the top one? Buy it. Purchase it on physical media, get a 4K ultra HD.
Yeah. I agree. This is a snap it up on physical media. This is a great watch. It's, you know, this is normally a different time of year. This is normally in the fall when we get like the awards contenders. And it's a lot of movies that feel like, oh, this is going to be a healthy dish of broccoli and brown rice. But this is an awards contender that's like just an enjoyable view. And there's so much to dig into. And yeah, I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I'm also physical media for all the reasons you guys said. This is exciting filmmaking. And yeah, these are performances you want to watch again. This is period detail you want to watch again, just like the architectural specifics of that motel room and of the cars and of the ice cream containers and all that stuff. Like I love the how baked in the 1960s-ness of this whole thing is. And yeah, I was... I have seen it twice already, and I think for sure it holds up and in fact rewards multiple viewings.
Yeah, and I'm also going to be a snap it up on physical media. This definitely feels like a film that maybe five or so years from now, teachers are just going to play probably during like Black History Month or something and being like, oh yeah, check this out. This is good. And honestly, I'm not mad at it, but it's like, all right. Like I just see it. I see the cart rolling into my class and being like, all right, kids, wait till I blow your socks off on this.
One night in Miami again. Yeah.
the best part will be when they bring it into the Spanish class and do it with the dub. Yeah. Because those are the
una
classes.
Noche en Miami.
Yeah, yeah. but yes, you heard it here. So, you know, enjoy it, love it. And we'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
I'm Jesse Thorne. On the next Bullseye, we've got the one and only Ted Danson. We'll talk about his new show, Mr. Mayor, about Cheers, and about the secret to success in comedy.
I mean, I feel like one of your signature comedic moves at this point in your career is gazing. You do a lot of interesting gazing.
I also love this. Gazing. I love that. And if I'm not, I'm going to start, because that's great.
That's Bullseye. Find it on MaximumFun.org, NPR.org, and wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duralde.
Clay Keller.
Drea Clark.
And since Sundance is this week, and we have two Sundance freaks among us, we're going to talk a bit about the festival. But before we get into that, I'm going to interject, because I was like, I'm going to jump in on this. I want to be a freak, a Sundance freak with y'all. It's accessible now. What the fuck is going on? Okay, like, here's the thing. One, I will say, I've had people, there's someone who was hitting me up, was real excited about Sundance being online now. It's more, because they never could afford to fly out, and it's way more accessible. And that I totally understand and I get. But the scheduling I didn't realize I missed everything. I didn't know that it was going to, my assumption was that since it was online, you'd pick the movies and do it. Yeah. Drea's shaking her head and I know, and I say this knowing that Sundance is probably such a nightmare with producers and distribution, because you want to make sure that, you know, people, you got to make the deal just juicy enough so these filmmakers are still making money at the end of this.
They don't make money. the filmmakers aren't paid from these. Did you buy a pass or individual tickets?
I was trying to buy, I'll tell you the two movies I wanted to see. One was First Date. I was real excited for that. You know, black lead, very cute. Seems like a fun idea. The second one is, of course, I had to support my boy, Gerard Carmichael, and On the Count of Three, which seems so phenomenal.
Both
of these films, I can still catch it. Oh, shit, I just missed it.
Yeah. Nope. So that's the part that did actually recreate. And obviously, like, for a lot of us, we are deep into virtual festivals. So I think that helps. A huge amount of the audience that would be going to the Sundance has maybe already been visiting other virtual festivals through the year. But a lot of it, it's much more that for either if a film already has distribution or a filmmaker, you know, Sundance is a marketplace. And so you're trying to attract distribution. And because of that, you need to set up screening so it's not just, oh, anytime during a week, you can look at this, because that's the same as having like an online release already. Whereas if, oh, you can buy a ticket to watch this film at 7 a.m. and we have a set amount of tickets. And then for other festivals, like for Bentonville, we did geo-tracking for things. So like we had films that you could only see if you lived within 100-mile radius of Bentonville in Arkansas. So a lot of it's because distributors, rightfully so, don't want future audiences or potential audiences, like if everyone could see it, then they're not going to come back when the distributor is trying to sell it. Or
for example, when I program for Outfest, there are certain movies that we're like, oh, hey, we want to show this at the Ford, which is a big outdoor amphitheater that seats like 1,000 people. And they'll come back and say, no, we want to show it in DGA 2, which is a house that seats like 350 people, because they only want it. They want to keep a limit on how many tickets that they let go before the distribution happens, so that when they have their opening weekend in LA, they haven't already shot their wad with most of what their potential audience would be. So you have to figure out the digital version of that, which is like, we have X number of tickets and you can only see it in this window, and that's how it
goes. I'm ecstatic if he brought this up, because I thought we'd just be talking about the films, and you guys, all I ever want to talk about is the nuts and bolts of scheduling and logistics. Yeah. Like, if we could just bring up, if I can screen share an Excel file with you guys right now, like, it's going to turn into a dream.
I was spoiled because I had an all-access press pass, and what that does is that once a movie has premiered and had its first screening, I could then go in and watch it whenever I wanted to until the end of the festival, which was just this past Wednesday. So that was handy, because that way I didn't have to deal with juggling. Oh no, these are showing at the same time and they're across town from each other. And, the problem is it's a lot easier to devote your life entirely to watching movies and writing about them when you are in a hotel room in Utah and not at home where you're expected to do all the things that you would be doing at home anyway.
And
like this podcast, for instance.
Yeah. No, ironically, that's something that we always faced with LA Film Fest for people that would go to destination festivals like Sundance, you're immersed in it. That's all you're doing. You're going to movies, you're going to talks, you're trying to sneak into parties. But in a town that's not a destination one, it's like Los Angeles, it's a whole thing of, oh, I'm going to go to like one or two movies rather than like five a day. I was really excited because so many people that I either know or follow were putting together these very intense schedules for themselves of watching, four some movies a day or more. Like my friend Doug Jones watched, I think, 7 or 8 movies a day.
He's an Iron
Man.
You know Doug. Speaking of parties, Drea, did you go into the virtual space where you had the little stick figure avatar with your head floating on top of it?
Yeah, I lasted about 10 minutes. Again,
me too. It freaked me out.
I can't, and that's not the first, like, there's other festivals that have had something similar to that. But I was just like, I don't, it's like the same thing I get when I play video games. I'm like, I don't, I don't know.
If I ran into somebody that I knew, I think I would have had a better time of like, okay, well, this is weird, but it's nice to see you and let's chat. But because I just was wandering around that space and seeing people I didn't know, and it was just like, eh, this is too weird.
Which it truthfully is very real festival.
Yes, that was the other thing.
I'm gonna do a lap.
It's my least favorite part of Sunday. It's going to a reception where I don't know anyone and no one wants to talk to me.
So I do want to just briefly, because as you guys know, like my... I think four or five of my festival, my Sundance favorites last year made my top 10 list this year, like Promising Young Woman and Minari and other. Yeah, it's just a lot of good choices. There's a lot of films that you are going to see that are coming out in quick succession, which is great. And one of the things that Casey was, that he was like, well, let's come up with some trends or themes, because you know Casey, he's a quick talking guy, he likes to make things interesting. So I don't know, the things I would recommend, especially since I primarily see narratives ahead of time, and American narratives specifically, like that's my real wheelhouse, as they say. So the docs are something I'm more exposed to after the fact. Technology, as explored in documentaries, was blowing my mind. There's a doc called Users that is super into like things like it has this whole the philosophical and practical applications of technology, like a crib that is soothes your baby. So like if you have like an upset crying baby in the middle, there's no like sleep training, the crib will do the work for you. And then what does that mean for parents, and what is the crib actually then the parent? And then so there's all things. All Light Everywhere is another sort of exploration, and has this whole trajectory of like crazy, I mean this is just a part of it, but like how cameras equate to guns, like in how we see the world and everything. And then Rodney Asher has this film called Glitch in the Matrix, which is a whole exploration of like a sub counterculture that believes that we're living in a simulation. And so he's like getting people to explain why that is, and you know, what AI and blah blah blah. And then midway through you're like, oh yeah, we definitely live in a simulation. It's good to know. I don't even need to worry if I get a crib that rocks a baby now, because this, none of this is real.
And that movie, by the way, is opening, like, if it's not already open in like for general release, it is very soon. So you can catch Rodney Asher's movie on digital cinemas and whatnot very soon. I did not get to see as many docs this year, unfortunately. But I did. There were a couple that I thought really kind of touched a lot of my sort of childhood TV memories. One is Street Gang, which is about the creation of Sesame Street, which is a fascinating story. And then there's also Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go for It. And of course, she's had, you know, an extraordinary lengthy career that's covered a lot of stuff. But it reminded me that my first real exposure to her was on the PBS kids show, The Electric Company. And only later it was like, oh, she was in West Side Story. Well, that's nice. That's the lady from The Electric Company, you know. So I enjoyed those two quite a bit. And the Rita Moreno doc is for American Masters, as is Amy Tan, Unintended Memoir, about the novelist Amy Tan. And, you know, when you're watching an American Masters doc, you kind of know what you're in for, formally speaking. But I think they lucked out in the case of these two women, in that they're really forthcoming about everything in their lives. And so often lately, we have these docs that are built around celebrities and their awesome lives, and the celebrities seem to have a lot of say into what goes in and what doesn't go in, and so you feel like it's a real sort of like whitewashed version sometimes. But like Rita Moreno tells you all the things about all these corners of her life, what, you know, what didn't work about her marriage and her relationship with Marlon Brando and all the awful stuff that led to, and it's very frank and forthcoming, and so I found it really powerful in a lot of ways. So those were great. And then of the narratives, I'm a big fan of a film called Together Together.
I love it.
I've been a Patty Harrison fan for a while. She's on Shrill, and her Twitter feed is just like a gonzo delight. But she, this is such a great performance in terms of, she's really, really funny, which I knew she would be, but also just wonderfully moving and dramatic. And so like, she is, I think, one of the stars being born at this festival. I didn't get to see Jockey, but I hear that this is Clifton Collins Jr.'s like big time to shine as well.
Yeah, I agree. Together Together is one of those small like indie. It's a two-hander of Ed Helms as Patty Harrison, and he hires her to be his surrogate to have his baby. He's having a baby by himself. And one of the small things, she's incredible in it, and she's also such a perfect example of when you look at casting that's truly who had the best audition or the best take, because Patty Harrison is a trans actress who's playing a obviously a cisgendered woman, and that she's a pregnancy surrogate, and so of course it never comes up, and there's just a beautiful performance of like this heart-wrenching but also very chill. It's not like moralizing, it's not whatever, it's just this woman and this man developing this unique platonic friendship and going through this unique thing in a lighthearted way, for as much as it could be very heady. I agree, I think she's fantastic. The big huge film out of the festival, of course, is Coda, which sold for $25 million to Apple, largely because my guess is they're going to make it a big awards piece for next year, but it's going to do a lot of box office.
And it's also Apple sending up a flare of like, hey, we're here and we're players in this.
Don't forget us, please.
Yeah,
for sure. We're
sorry
here.
About Servant.
Yeah, we want these kinds of films. It's an adaptation of a French film that did really well, and it's super likable. It's this teen girl in this fishing village with, she's the child of deaf adults, which is what CODA stands for. And both parents, it's Marley Matlin and Kurt something. Oh, no. Anyway, both the actors who play her parents are actually deaf, and it's really wonderful, and she wants to be a singer. And so, of course, there's a little irony cooked into that. I don't know if you guys notice the irony there of her being a singer with
Troy Kotsur.
Kotsur. I blended all those letters and made the word Kurt. But he does a lovely job. And yeah, that was a big one. And it's also the second Fishing Village movie I watched at Sundance, because there's a film set in Malta. And then the other, like, I loved Passing. That'll be one that we'll be hearing a lot. And
Netflix just picked it up.
Yeah. And Jockey's wonderful as Alonzo Guest.
Pleasure is a tough sit, but great. It's about a woman who comes to LA from Sweden to make it big in the porn industry. But it's really a movie about just workplace issues and like the things that women are asked to accept in male-dominated workspaces, and it's devastating but brilliant. And Ify, you'll be glad to know that On the Count of Three is also really terrific.
Oh, see,
it is. I love that.
It won the award. I just saw. That's why I thought I could see it. But then it was like, it was at 7 a.m., bitch. I was like, okay, I guess not. What'd you think of Night of the Kings?
Didn't see it.
I haven't seen that.
Okay. I hear good things. I liked Crypto Zoo, which is Dash Shaw's new film. I like his weird sense of animated storytelling. He's the guy who did My Entire High School Sinking into the Sea. And I had a couple that I wasn't crazy about. I'm just going to throw out real quick.
Yes.
I'm a big Sion Sono fan. Like, his four-hour movie, Love Exposure, is like bonkers and brilliant, one of my favorites. Didn't love Prisoners of the Ghost Land, his first film in English, starring Nicolas Cage. It just, you know, his movies never go from A to B, you know, in a smooth way. That's not what you're signing up for. But this one to me felt particularly like, what are we even doing here? Where's this even going? And I'm very much in the minority on this one because it's got really great reviews. But I think Mass starts strong and has four really great performances and then just kind of doesn't know where to go with it. It's about the parents of the victim of a mass shooting meeting the parents of the shooter. So obviously it's pregnant with dramatic potential. And, you know, the cast includes Martha Plimpton and
Dan Dowd
and Jason Isaacs, and you know, there's a lot that works, but I think it doesn't know how to get to the finish line, and it wants to sort of tie this very messy ball of human emotions up into too neat a bow. So I was a little let down by that.
Okay, well, that was riveting and exciting and made me even more salty that I couldn't figure out how the schedule works.
Andrea will be recommending films from this festival for the rest of the year.
Shorts.
Speaking
you're lucky.
Of recommending films from this very festival, it's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Alonzo, why don't you start?
I was thinking about why did this whole four historical figures in a hotel room thing ring a bell for me, and it reminded reminded me of the premise of Nicholas Roeg's Insignificance, in which Marilyn Monroe, Albert Einstein, Joe DiMaggio, and Joseph McCarthy all cross paths in a New York hotel room one hot summer night in the 1950s. It's an odd film. That's about the only thing it has in common with One Night in Miami, because it is very metaphorical and very, very Nicholas Roeg. I don't know how else to put it. But it's a movie I like a lot, and the performances are dynamite. The scene where Teresa Russell as Marilyn Monroe explains the theory of relativity to Albert Einstein using a toy train, a balloon, and a flashlight is an all-timer. So it's streaming on the Criterion Channel, Insignificance.
Clay, what movie did you think he was going to say?
Insignificance you is did. What I thought he was going to say. Yeah, no, I almost brought that up during the discussion of One Night in Miami, but I was like, we're talking about this movie. We don't need to get into a side discussion. But yeah, Alonzo, I'm glad you brought that up. I watched that movie on a lark a couple years ago and then thought it was really beguiling and strange. And then I looked up, I thought it was interesting that Tony Curtis was acting in scenes opposite a woman playing Marilyn Monroe. Right. Cause I was like, oh, he knew her in real life. I did not realize the extent to which he knew her, because I looked it up online, and not only were they co-stars, they apparently, according to him, had an affair, and she got pregnant and had a miscarriage.
Oh.
And in the film Insignificance, he as Joe McCarthy smacks her around so much that she has a miscarriage in the movie.
Yikes.
So that seems, I mean, not to throw like a pail of water, the movie's crazy and interesting, but knowing that backstory and knowing Tony Curtis played that in the movie with that personal history in his head was something that haunts my mind.
I had missed that story, and now I will never not think of it when I'm talking about this film. So...
anyway, so I had an Insignificance anecdote. Yeah, no, it's in his book that he came out with, you know, right before he died.
My staff pick for the week is a Netflix release called The Dig.
I want to see that.
Yeah, with Carey Mulligan and Ralph Fiennes. And Ralph Fiennes has this wonderful, like, Suffolk, like, this accent of, like, working man. Like, he's just, shouldn't forget, but I do forget. He's just such a wonderful actor, you guys.
Hot take from Drea.
Yeah, hot take. Ralph Fiennes. Keep an eye out on this guy. But yeah, so it's a period piece based on a real life excavation that happened at this wealthy woman's estate. But this wonderful performances and super fast moving, and also very, to me, like, oh, this was not a three act structure. Like, there's characters that are introduced midway through that are like, oh, this is one of your new lead characters, and you're like, all right, come aboard, why not, good to see you, Johnny Flynn, come on. Hey, how you doing, Lily James? Like, it's kind of sporadic in its layout, but it's beautiful, and it's just a fun mom watch. I'm not a mom, but, you know, I enjoy a mom watch. Like, just
nothing
like
wrong with a mom
just like
watch.
I love a dad movie, and I love a mom watch.
Yeah. A mom watch on Super Bowl Sunday is the best.
Yeah. Well, mine was going to obviously be the easiest jump off from this movie to my well of books. And of course, the autobiography of Malcolm X with Denzel Washington, which was a definitive performance for me for him. When I saw that, I was like, oh, he acting, many argue that's when he should have got the Oscar and not for Training Day. But I rewatched Training Day and I was like, yeah, this is still pretty good. Like, it is like that, but it was very much a like, all right, here you go. Sorry.
We
Oscars.
Were wrong.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. We're in this like endless loop with the Academy where there's so many people they owe it to. So like, it's going to be one year that is inevitably going to lead to another apology Oscar because
nobody is owed an Academy Award.
Okay.
No, there's a great saying though, that like the right people win Oscars, but almost never for the right movie.
Yeah,
true. That's true.
Big facts.
Speaking of Denzel, I do want to shout out Aldis Hodge in the movie we talked about today. Yes. He has the least flashy part.
Yeah.
But there's some moments where he just kind of quietly, stoically sits back with a little grin on his face. And I'm like, oh, he's throwing Denzel movie starring.
Yeah, no, right it definitely. I to kind of drag that discussion into here real quick. I did. That is a good point to make. You would think that Malcolm X would be the big figure around there, but you have so many big personalities that it was played so well that he just leaned more into the stoicness, and then he really unleashed it when he was coming at Sam Cooke. But I did like that he did not go the whole movie. No man can play Malcolm X without doing at least one. Legs crossed, finger on the glasses. Like, no, it is yet to happen. It will never happen. I feel like the estate of Malcolm X is like, sorry, if you're going to.
It's in our writer.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, I want to know what Clay's staff pick is.
Oh.
Oh, my staff pick was that upsetting historical tidbit about insignificance. I had that locked and loaded. No, my gosh, what should I do for my staff pick? Okay, so I will do the more fun one. So I watched recently to fall asleep. I like to watch like mid-range thrillers from the late 80s through early 2000s that I may have missed. And I watched a really fun one on Prime the other night called Shattered.
Oh, Tom Berenger?
It's an amnesia thriller.
Oh my God, the Tom Berenger movie?
The Tom Berenger movie.
Oh, yes, yes, my friend. I do know that.
Saw it when it came out.
I had never, and I've been researching this subgenre for many, many years, and I had never come across this one, but I saw someone tweet about it. It may have been Kate Hagen, but somebody tweeted about it. And I said, okay, I got to add this to the list. It's basically about this rich guy who gets in this insane car accident at the beginning of the movie that his wife is thrown free from the car and he gets the full brunt of the accident. When he wakes up after like months of reconstructive surgery and stuff, he does not remember who he is. And so he gets kind of his wife is sort of reintroducing him to his life, being the co-owner of this successful architecture firm with Corbin Burnson. And it seems all too good to be true. And things he starts to get a little suspicious of stuff. He finds that he had like the number of a private detective.
Don't
he goes
give
to see
the
him,
whole
Bob
movie.
Hoskins. What?
Don't give away the whole movie. I want
Not,
people
okay,
to,
sorry. Anyway,
I
Bob
need
Hoskins,
them to see this movie now.
Bob Hoskins is in this as a hilarious a pet store owning private detective who's helping him try to figure out what actually happened. It's one of the kookiest. It's got like a 40s style treating. It gives everything away. This is a crazy amnesia movie.
Is Greta Scacchi in this?
Oh God, she seems like she would be, right?
Greta Scacchi.
Yes, yeah. She's his wife.
Yeah.
And Joanne Whaley is in it.
Yep.
As Corbin Burnson's wife, and it is a nutty movie. It takes the premise, like the sort of science fiction-y parts of amnesia movies, and turns them up to 11. And it's a good time if you like kind of forgotten studio thrillers from the 90s. Shattered.
Oh, from
really
from
fun.
The
it's on Prime
from
right
the
now.
Director of Das Boot. Ooh,
It's written and directed by Wolfgang Petersen.
Oh my God, I forgot that. Amazing.
It's a nutty movie.
We like Shattered. Nutty movies around this part. So that was an amazing staff pick. So you were nervous about it, and then you knocked it out the park. How you feel about that?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Clay. Thank you so much for joining us. Anything you'd like to plug before we get up on out of here?
Oh my goodness. It was an honor to be on with you guys. I enjoy all of you so much and love having you on my show. And I've been on a personal note. I've been a listener to the Maximum Fun Network since I was in college.
Oh, wow.
So it's very fun to make an appearance
last year.
On this network as well. Yeah, just want to, I guess I'll plug my podcast. It's called Screen Drafts, where two people, sometimes more, come on and competitively build a single definitive best of list from a given topic. It's alternating picks. There's vetoes. So there's strategy and all kinds of other insanity. Drea, Alonzo, and Iffy have all been on. So if you love them, go back in the archive, find an episode featuring one of them. Alonzo did an episode about art house Christmas movies, an episode about the filmography of Pedro Almodovar. Both great episodes. If he did a con artist draft with his buddy Demi Adejuyibe, really fun time having you guys on. Andrea's on. She's got more than I can remember. So
she's on more episodes than Clay at this point.
Yeah, check it out. Screen Drafts. We have a lot of fun.
Ooh, all right.
Thanks for coming, Clay.
Yes, yay. We love you.
Clay's, oh, thank you, guys.
Clay's from Minnesota.
Ah.
Well, I was going to say,
bonus points.
You know, I know that in One Night in Miami, they are talking yes. about how incredibly well this white boy from Minnesota was able to speak about
yeah
about the civil rights movement.
Also,
I doubt that I brought the same heat as Bob Dylan. But, thank you.
I didn't know Bob Dylan was from
Minnesota. I was like, oh, that's I learned something about Bob Dylan.
Yes, we got Bob Dylan and Prince.
Yeah, I didn't hear the accent when he's talking like this. Don't you know? thank you. That's been my time.
Oh my god.
It might sound a little something like this.
Oh, Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. Anything that you'd like to plug?
Bang.
Okay.
Nope.
Well, on that note, if you'd like to support the show, then go ahead and head over to MaximumFun.org/join. And if you'd like to purchase a Jumbotron, go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's 100 for a personal message, 200 for a promotional one. Again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY 803-1664. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/Who Shot Your Podcast, or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.